I'm here in the County Hall in Talla and I'm talking to Joe Williams. Joe, you're from Clondalkin,
yep.
Just out the road.
Yeah, I lived in Clondalkin since 1970, 71.
And before that?
Before that, I spent 9 years in the British Army, and my father moved around a lot in his job, but when I was 7 years old, my mother died, and we went to live with his mother in Mill Lane and Palmerstown. So I look upon myself as from Mill Lane and Palmerstown. That's how I had my formative years.
Now, before we go forward, just a little bit about your background. How far back can you go? Where did the Williamses originally come from?
I'm a bit stuck on that because my grandfather met his wife, this is on my father's side, the Williamses, in London, in Paddington. She was a barrow girl along behind Paddington Station. And I've traced their family back to there, and I've traced her family back to the 1800s. But family lore has it, he's from Wales, but I can't find him. Williams is the third commonest name in the British Isles, and it's just impossible. Well, it's not impossible, but I haven't gone to Wales to do an in-depth look for him. So he was one of the first electricians, and he's reputed to have put the electricity into the Old Vic in London. And he then moved up to Norfolk, and he eventually was employed by Lord Ivy to put the electricity in Elverton Hall. Now, I've been there and I've been seen where they lived. He was a foreman status there. I actually met Lord Ivy and he brought me around the estate and showed me. And then Lord Ivy, now this is the present Lord Ivy's great-grandfather we're talking about, asked him to come over and put in the electricity in Farmley.
Mm-hmm.
And he manned a pumping station and an electrical generator down the Mill Lane in Palmerstown, which pumped water and electricity across to Farmley. It also put electricity into Knockmaroon. And if you know that area, the bridge across the River Liffey, the Iron Bridge, and the clock tower in Farmley. Clock tower is actually a water tower. And the Iron Bridge was put there to take the pipes across. It was a private bridge. And Lord Ivy's family were the only one allowed to use it. It had locked gates on either side. And there was a ferry just below it. And that's where my grandfather had to use to come to work. In January 1912, he was coming home from work. Some say having been delayed in the Angler's Rest. And he was standing on the edge of the river waiting for the ferryman to come down. And they think he put his back into the wind. He was wearing a short cape with a bowler hat. The cape blew over his head. He got disorientated and stepped into the Liffey.
And he drowned?
And he drowned.
My goodness, yeah.
My grandmother had 8 children, 7 of which were born in England, and my father had been born. They came over here in 1904 or somewhere around there.
The beginning of the century.
Lord Ivy offered to bring them all back to Elverton, but he wouldn't ship the body home to Elverton.
Why?
I don't know. Maybe the cost was too high for a special casket. I don't know how they did it. Maybe they just didn't do it in those days.
Yeah.
And my grandfather was buried in Castleknock Protestant Churchyard. And grandmother refused to leave Ireland. And that was 1912. And she missed 100 by 5 months and died in the 1950s. And eventually was buried beside her.
So you knew her very well?
Yeah, not very well. Grandmother was a matriarch. She didn't talk to my father, let alone me.
Did she not?
But my grandmother, and I think this is where my local history stands from.
Yeah.
But my grandfather had lived through five British reigns. She remembers Wild Bill Hickok and Buffalo Bill Circus coming over to London. Her eldest daughter, who again I was very close to, more close to, and she told me the family, a lot of the family history. She remembers standing on the mall waving goodbye to the troops going to the Boer War. So I had this background.
Great link altogether, my goodness, yeah.
And then I had two uncles fought and survived the First World War. And I had a cousin who flew bombers in the Second World War and survived it.
So a lot of military history in the family.
Yeah, but sort of incidental military history, not career military history. Although that aunt, Sis, she married a British soldier, a British officer, as she said to me once, no decent Protestant girl who didn't get a good marriage during the First World War should be ashamed of herself. There was men over here with nothing to do but pick up girls. And she married an engineer officer.
We're working where?
He was stationed in the Phoenix Park, I believe. But he must have worked here because their first son, who only died a couple of weeks ago, their only son, he was born here in Dublin. Although the family went back. And they were living in the house in Palmerstown, Mill Lane, Rose Cottage, Mill Lane, Palmerstown. And the story, again, the aunt was great for telling these things. When her husband got decorated in the First World War, and it was a big enough decoration. They were known as palace gongs, that they went to the palace to get their decoration. But she was pregnant. And of course, in those days, pregnant ladies weren't allowed anywhere near royalty. And when her son joined the RAF in 1940, she's reputed to have said to him, "You did me out of going to the palace. You better get a good, decent enough medal to bring me to the palace this time." And he did.
That was a good telling off, wasn't
it? Yeah.
So he was highly awarded for bravery and
he's unique in, and his crew is unique. They survived 33 raids on Germany and Italy, which is, you know, bomber crews rarely survived over 20 or anywhere even near 20. And he went on then to do another 33 flights as a Pathfinder, and that's the crowd that went out ahead of the bombers, lit up the target, and then stayed behind there and photographed the damage afterwards and had to bring it back. And in the bombers, he reckoned his crew survived because, against orders, every one of them learned everybody's job, and he was the navigator. And his pilot and co-pilot, one was killed and the other was badly wounded, and he took over the controls and landed the plane.
But he was obviously trained in flying the plane.
He was
well.
Training yes. to fly yes. planes, because that's how he went on to fly.
So he was thrown in at the deep end, really, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And he brought it down safely. My goodness. And did he talk much about the warriors?
He didn't talk at all about it. I remember going over when I was about 14, 15, I used to go over to this aunt in Romford in Essex and go down to his house. And he was county engineer for Hereford. And his mother had to persuade him, bully him really, into showing me his medals. He had to go and find them in the house. And only in the latter years, after his mother died, she, instead of keeping a diary, she wrote poems about where everywhere she'd been and members of her family, and he put them together as a book. And then after that, they're doing what you're doing now in Britain. You see it on BBC in that they're asking people to write in their war experiences. And any survivors of the war, especially of the RAF, because there weren't many, They're getting them to write. So he then wrote and published a little booklet on his wartime. That's when we first got to see it all.
Can you tell me, where was he stationed first?
I do know. I mean, I have the book.
But he was brought up here.
No, only for a short time.
Yeah,
he was. So, I mean, he was English. I find this hard to comprehend.
Yeah,
I've got a younger cousin from another brother of my father's, and I'm quite close to him. I stayed with him when I went to the funeral last week, and you know, he comes over for the rugby matches here, and that's when I see him every 2 years. And I say to him, you know, why are you following England? But I forget he is English. Totally, you know, yeah. And his father was.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, I suppose that's a good reason why you joined the army as well, which we'll come on to in a minute. But
not really, yeah, you know, but there, yeah, there was no... Well, yes, I suppose I did have background.
But were you brought up here in...
Yes,
and I went to school...
Yeah, I started in Shankill because we were living out there in Loughlinstown before my mother died. And then we moved to Drimna. And I was being brought up as a Roman Catholic because my mother was a Roman Catholic. My father was a Protestant.
Church of Ireland?
Church of Ireland, yes. And they, in actual fact, she was from Loughlinstown. And her and dad met, and they went to get married, and the parish priest in Loughlinstown wouldn't marry them because they were a mixed marriage. The curate agreed to marry them, but the parish priest then went to McQuaid, the archbishop, and he refused to let them marry within the Diocese of Dublin. And the story is the curate had a friend who was a curate in not Clonie, and which is in the parish of Meath, in the Diocese of Meath.
Yes.
And they got married there.
My goodness, yeah, yeah, yeah. Somewhere up near...
I think of it in a few minutes.
Drogheda direction.
No, it's down near Clonie, around Clonie, just yes, over. You wouldn't know it was in Meath, you know, yeah, just on the border.
So
there.
They had a very hard start, so, I mean, it was difficult.
Even
for
to the extent that my father's parents didn't go into the church proper, as far as I know. My father, she'd only his mother and his sisters and brothers, because they were Protestant. It was a Catholic church.
But in any case, you were brought up in the Catholic tradition.
And the day I was making my Holy Communion, we were living in Drimna Road, and I went up. My mother's sister was bringing me to the church because my mother was ill, and I went up to the bedroom and stood beside the bed, dressed for to go. My mother straightened my tie, and that's the last time I saw my mother. As we came back, I can't remember the communion service. I can't remember who we visited that day, and we must have visited aunts and people. And as I was coming back on a bus, and we were just past where the children's hospital is now, it wasn't built in those days, an ambulance went past us going into town, and my mother was in that ambulance. And she went to the Adelaide Hospital. She died 4 days later. And I never saw her.
So it was all very sudden for you.
Yes. Well, I knew she died, and her mother and father had died the previous year. It was very...
Yeah, I know.
Three of them died within 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
And after the... at the time, when she was for the day of my communion, and after the, till after the funeral, my two brothers... myself, three of us. There was actually four. The first brother is older than me, and he died young. He died just after I was born. of meningitis, which is funnily what my mother died of as well. And the three of us went to various sisters of hers. The one I'd been with my communion was a maiden aunt, but there was two married sisters.
Mm-hmm.
One, Sheila Connolly, whose husband Tom Connolly in Dunleary was saved off the Leinster. He was a cabin boy on the Leinster. And we went and stayed with them. And then the day of the funeral, the family gathered. Now, we weren't there, of course, because we didn't go to the funeral. And grandmother supposed to walked up to Dad and said, "Right, Ernie, get the children, we're going home." And she would have been in her 70s then. And she took us on.
Well, I must say that, and how many of you, how many brothers and sisters?
Well, there was three brothers. There was myself, who was sevenish, a younger brother who's 4 years younger than me. And then another brother who's about 2 years younger than that. He was only a baby. We all went back to grandmother, and my father had had a girl coming in to help mother in the home because she'd been ill for quite a while. And she came out and lived with to help Gran. But of course, Gran being the person she was, she couldn't put up with her and got rid of her as quick as she could.
I suppose clash of personalities, yeah.
And clash of religions and clash of everything else.
Yeah.
And my...
So were you brought up by your grandmother then?
Basically.
Yes.
Yeah, I was, and my one brother was, but my youngest brother, my father had a brother of his, Jim, who was married, and presumably I don't know what they did, but they hadn't children. Now, it was presumably it came out that they couldn't have children. And he took the youngest brother. But he didn't adopt him. You know, they didn't in those days. You just... Now, we always knew he was our brother. And he always knew my father was his proper father. But he called Jim and Martha, which were his aunt and uncle, mum and dad. And he called my father Daddy Ernie.
It's a little bit confusing, but you can see, you know, the reasons why.
It gets more confusing than that. So, as you can imagine, grandmother was 70. She had a married daughter, living here, who again had one child die at birth and seemingly couldn't have any more after that. And her husband was a traveller, and she used to come out and live with us from Monday to Thursday and then go back to her own home with her husband for the weekends. And she helped out that way. And I'm not sure the sequence of this, but my father then met a woman he knew. He either knew her, I know her brothers and father's brothers were friends. She lived in Castleknock. She was a Protestant. And they decided to get married. And Dad came to me and he said that but as she's also a Protestant.
They were going to get married now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But because she was a Protestant.
And of course, the other brother that was living with us had been too young to make communion or get involved in religion in any way. Now, after my mother died for 2 years, while we lived in Palmerstown, neighbours brought me to Mass and confession, and I went to the Catholic Church, the school in Palmerstown. I was enrolled in it. Dad kept his promise to my mother that he'd bring me up as a Catholic for those 2 years. I found out since that when he met Bunny, who's second name, that was her nickname, he went to my mother's sister, who he brought us to regularly to visit, and explained what was going to happen, and said to them, I'd rather bring Joe as a good Protestant than a bad Catholic. That with a family of Protestants, it just wouldn't be possible. And as far as I'm concerned, that's when I became an atheist, because Dad admitted to me in later years that the day he told me, I turned to him and said, it doesn't matter, I don't believe in God anyway, at about 9 or 10.
Imagine, yes. I mean, you were... And how do you feel now, after all those...
Oh, totally. I've never changed my mind.
Did you not?
No.
Yeah. But continue with your life story. You entered the British Army. Were you a young lad when you did that? And
yeah.
Why did you do it? Why did you join the British
Army?
Two
things. When I changed religion, I changed schools to a Protestant school in Chapel Izzard. And then through a friend, Dad heard that it was run by two women, the Mrs. Little and her daughter. And Dad heard of a school in Dublin that was supposed to be very good, and I moved to there, and that was Kildare Place Training College, attached to the Dáil in Kildare Place in Kildare Street. But attached to that was a national school where the trainee teachers would go at times to think they were, it was a Protestant training college for
what was it called?
Kildare Place Training College. It's moved out to Rathmines.
And that's where you went to school?
And I went to school there for...
sorry.
For just national school. And I mean, that was very military orientated. Of my senior class, sixth class, because I didn't go to secondary school, you had to have a scholarship or your parents had to have money. There was, you know, no free education. And eight boys of the class around my class, either the one my year or the year under me, seven of them joined the British forces and one became an officer in the Air Corps.
Because you're 69 now, so that was in what year? That was in...
1953.
In 1953.
I left school in 53.
So the memories of the Second World War were very much still in everybody's mind.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Was that another reason maybe why you went
to... Hard to know. I mean, I can vaguely remember listening to the radios and hearing... the one I remember is tanks advancing into somewhere in Germany. The commentator talking about that. And I remember my cousin... He got through the war without being injured and then fell with a champagne bottle when he was at his demob party and split his arm open. And coming home over and staying with us for a while, you know, so not in uniform, because of course you wouldn't come here in uniform. And I went to Kildare Street. In the meantime, after 2 years, my stepmother had become the proverbial stepmother. And I bore the brunt of it. I've got the scars, physical and mental, to prove it. And
you're joking. You mean she was that tough on you?
Yeah, I've got a scar in the back of my head where she hit me with a bread knife. And luckily enough, I was wearing a skull cap, but it still split my head. That'll give you an idea how. Now, again, I can think of it like talking to you. I can remember bits of it.
I know, but
otherwise you
put a blank out in your mind. But why was she so vicious with you?
No idea. And Dad wouldn't talk about it. I'm always sorry now that
I
never...
Is this the woman, Bunny, you spoke about?
Yeah.
And is this because maybe she wasn't your real mother? Something had to do with it?
But
Or was she the same with your other siblings?
Well, he was a bit younger than me, and he doesn't talk about it either. But then he would have been, this would have been 9 to 11, so he would have been 4 years, 5 to 7 sort of thing. So whether he just forgets it or has blocked it out as well, we don't really talk. This particular brother, he's the very opposite to me. He became a Roman Catholic. He's very religious. He's not interested in local history. He thinks I'm mad. You know, that sort of thing. He was a worker all his life and you know, a tradesman sort of thing.
What did that do to you? What did it do to you mentally?
I don't know. Other than blacking it out, it didn't do anything to me mentally.
It didn't make you a weak person or a strong person?
So.
Or
no, because my father said he went to the headmaster in school. He was a fabulous headmaster. And he taught things. I mean, you'd go in there now. It was only a national school. And it, as I say, it was oriented. I remember him standing us all to 2 minute silence when King George died. And, but he was a Northern Ireland Presbyterian. And, but he loved hunting and fishing and shooting. And like you'd come in, and when I was older than others, a lot of the others had gone on to secondary school, and I was still there. Nice salmon down the car, go down and get it. And he'd give us a nice salmon down in the car, like where he'd come straight up from Galway to school. And I'd go down and get it. He'd go down. And then he'd do a nature class with us about the salmon, about them. I mean, I knew things about the salmons going out into the sea to grow and coming back to spawn and all that. And then he'd do an art. He'd stand it up. Or he'd put it up and we'd have to do a drawing class with it.
Yeah, but that was terrific, wasn't
and,
it?
And
yeah,
that
yeah.
sort of thing. Yeah. And there was a terrific library, a little library, and I got to control it in the end. And my aunts had always got, my father even, had always got me into reading.
So, with that kind of background, you found yourself, I suppose,
well, I was never
towards the British Army. Is that right?
Yeah, I had the inclination, I suppose. But in actual fact, my father went to see him when I was about when it came up to do scholarships for secondary school, and he said to my dad, told me this after. He said to father, "You're wasting your time putting Joe into a scholarship. He'll only ever learn enough to get through his exams." And that's not good enough for a scholarship because you had to get to the top. And he said, but leave him. I'll get him a job when he's finished in Parks of the Coombe, it happened. And Dad said, well, that'll be a bit of a dead-end job. But he said, yeah, but he'll find his own way of it. And that's what happened at school at 14 with a very bad primary cert. I mean, I remember when the results came back. And we were in Kildare Street. And what happened in those days, the papers went to the nearest national school. And the nearest national school to us was Loretto the Green, the junior section of that. And he says, and I think I'd written about two lines of Irish, because my Irish was never bad. I regret it nowadays, being a local historian. And when it came back that I'd passed the primary cert, he said, that's those nuns. Oh, you were a Protestant, knew you wouldn't know, so they took pity on you and marked you up and gave you the passport. And he got me a job in Parks of the Coombe, which was wholesale hardware. And my idea was always, I wanted to become a policeman, a London Metropolitan policeman. And they had a cadetship. But I don't know whether I was finding girls in those days and that sort of thing, and whether it was a bit too much to go away, because you would have had to go away at 15, and it was a semi-military thing, because the British Army had a national service at the time. And I met my, who turned out to be my wife, and I was in Parks of the Coombe, and we were talking about getting married. And I went to see the manager in Parks of the Coombe and told him I was thinking about getting married. And this was a Protestant house, so you got a lecture. If you belonged to his parish and you hadn't turned up for church, you were pulled up on the mat the next morning. And, I mean, people think that Roman, or those days, thought the Roman Catholic religion was much stauncher than the Protestant religion. But when you were in the Protestant religion, it wasn't. You know, you were very staunch and very...
Black. Black Protestant.
You did it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And our wages, we weren't unionized. The clerical staff weren't unionized. The workers were. And I went to him in March to talk about getting an increase and told him why. And he gave me 10 shillings a week extra, which brought me up to about £5 a week, which wasn't bad wages in those days. And then August was my anniversary of joining the firm, my fifth anniversary. And normally we got 10 shillings a week on our anniversary. And when it came to that, I didn't get an increase. And gave it a couple of weeks and then went down and asked why. And was told, oh, well, you got it in March. And that was his only condescending to helping me save to get married.
My goodness, yeah. But at this stage, you...
stage, I'd been thinking about the Metropolitan Police. And I went regularly to England, to London on holidays to my aunt. And I checked out. And they wouldn't take you if you hadn't gone through the cadet service until you'd done your national service, which meant going to England to work for 2 years because you weren't called up straight away. And you couldn't guarantee to be called up after 2 years and then doing 2 years national service.
And it was a long way away. And
all on low pay.
And that was the reason why you didn't go.
Yeah. Originally, I think I was just afraid of going as a very young kid. And as I said, I had girlfriends at the time and I didn't want to leave that sort of thing. And
did you return home then?
No, I didn't go to England. I wrote to the Metropolitan Police.
And you stayed at home?
Yeah, I was still staying at home, still working in parks. And when I went down and was told I wasn't getting an increase, my proper increase, I said to the Mr. Doherty, the general manager, I said, well, then can I have next Friday off? And he said, why? And I said, because I want to go to Belfast and join the British Army. And he said, oh, you're giving me notice then? And I said, no, sir, I'll ring you from Belfast if I get this, but I mightn't be accepted because you're too medical and all sorts of things. And I went to Belfast the next Friday. And the guy I met a recruiting sergeant in the Royal Engineers. And unlike today, in those days, every regiment and every corps recruited to their own corps. Now you go into a holding corps to train and then you're put out to wherever they tell you. And he sat me down and I did... a multiple choice intelligence test. And he said to me, when you do this, when I did that, he said, you can go as a postal worker in the Royal Engineers or a movement control clerk in the Royal Engineers.
That was your choice?
Yeah.
Which one did you take?
And he said, I recommend movement control clerk. And then I said, right, 3 years, and found out because the IRA, this was 1958, I started work in 53, this was 1958, and the IRA campaign had just ended. And they had discovered that some of the people they arrested for that had got their military training by joining the British Army for 3 years. And, then deserting after them. So you could only join the British Army for 3 years if you went to the Brigade of Guards. And he said to me, if you go to the Brigade of Guards, it'll kill you. Not the boredom, he said. Just, being the bull and the uniforms and getting everything ready and then doing nothing but military.
But that's an interesting point you just brought up, that the Irish, I suppose, the the Irish Catholics. No, I better get this. So some of the people in the north then were actually joining the British Army to get training, and then they deserted.
So they told me. Now, I've never found...
Did you meet anyone?
No, yeah. I never found anybody who did that.
Did you not?
No.
And so you went ahead anyway yourself.
And then I went, and he said, sign up for 6 years. He said, you can still do 6 years and still they'd still take you into the Metropolitan Police Force. And then it turned out that I'd get, I forget about what it was, but it was more money if I joined for 9 years. And while the police force only took civilians until they were 27, they took ex-military till they were 30. And I would have been 29 at the end of 9 years.
And did you sign up for 6 or 9 years?
Nine years. Then signed for 9 years to get more money, because I still had the idea and I did it.
And did you stick it out for 9 years?
Yes.